Oh, before I do that, I just want to give you this little handout, which we haven't done much with this, or even anything with this weekend. It's just a new sort of little handout that has the spheres of the Tree of Life with the tarot cards. The tarot trump cards represent the paths that connect the different places inside ourselves. And it's just a useful image. It's in the book, but it's not graphic in the book, and it's just. And I just thought having that would be handy. I'll talk some more about it another weekend and just pass it around for that would be great. In a way, we started off this weekend with the wasteland, with the experience of fragmentation, of dryness, of absence of flow. And one of the things that we went on to look at yesterday in particular really was the complexity of the inner dialogue within us that cuts ourselves off in a way from our own wellspring. And, you know, we looked, using the diagram of the Tree of Life, really looked at the different kinds of dialogues that keep, in a way, trying to recreate the past, that in a way hijack the creative energy that's arising out of the core of our deepest places, but keep diverting it through the various inner dialogues that happen faster than thought, faster than consciousness, so as to keep our sense of ourself and our sense of the world intact and in balance. And in a way, probably the main reason that happens is because however complicated and difficult our view of ourselves and the world, we know we can do it. We know we can survive in it. We may not thrive in it particularly, but we know that we can live with it. And the experience of the unknown, while it is exciting, is also always frightening because it destabilizes that structure. Now, the problem with that structure is the structure is a dynamic structure that is happening so quickly it feels really solid. So the repeating patterns of at least my life always feel like, oh yeah, I knew that would happen, that always happens to me, that's how life is. It has a kind of solidity. Now, if it was really solid, we'd be screwed, but actually the solidity is actually an illusion because its solidity comes out of momentum. You know, it's like if you, a great image the Buddha used once about the self was, self is like like a ring of fire created in the night, created by swinging a torch really, really quickly, really fast. So that if you happen to hit the ring of fire, it would feel solid, it would feel burning, but actually if you could move slightly faster than it or in between, you would go straight through it. And that, in a way, is what these shapes are all about. They are a dialogue that happens immensely fast so that it feels solid. But what it does all the time, because it is a dialogue, it is constantly taking the energy of the moment, the energy arising from the depths, taking the experience coming towards our senses, and twisting and manipulating it into a familiar shape. As we find ways of slowing down the inner dialogue or diverting the inner dialogue or doing something else with it, what we start to find is our sense of self and our experience of the world starts to alter. Now, the two principal tools that we're using in this is that one is the Tree of Life and the sort of exercises that come out of that. The other are the kind of the poem and the Welsh stories. And in some ways, I suppose we could say that, you know, the Tree of Life helps our minds. It's got a shape. It's not just mental, because there are various exercises that come off it that are much more than that. But the the reason I use both these things is in a way the tree of life and its diagram and its ways of understanding the psyche give our minds some way of understanding, getting a handle on these kind of inner processes. The Welsh stories and poems, which in some ways are much more mysterious and paradoxical and much less obviously clear than the stuff that comes out of the Tree of Life, are there in order to help the kind of the non-rational parts of our mind. And of course, in the stories there are rational things. In the Tree of Life there are profoundly non-rational things. So there's, as ever, there's duality in everything and confusion in everything. But these, in a way, are the two wings of our work. And depending on where we are each weekend, one will get more stressed than another. In a way, it's been quite equal this weekend. We spent a whole day today more or less looking at the Grail stories and the previous day much of the time looking at the Tree of Life and those dynamics. Now the point is really what happens when we put these things together, not in a technical sense, but just in our felt sense of our bodies. Where does all this take us to? So by using the tree, we start to get some understanding of, hopefully, of the kind of the specific inner dialogues that run us. What we also get, hopefully, is a sense of that deeper expanse and a sense of opening out that inner dialogue. Now the practical exercise we used yesterday for that was the Kabbalistic cross, the middle pillar and the angel. So that was really working with our structure, working with us, but bringing a wider kind of a set of energies around that. So that the intense, very personal, very repetitive dialogue actually starts to get held in a wider structure. We bring more energy into the body and into our energetic bodies using the cross and the middle pillar exercises. So we start to loosen up some of our inner energetic holding as well as our mental and emotional holding. And in a way, and then today what we've gone on to look at, in a sense, is by looking at the elucidation and to really reflect upon this idea of the wasteland in another way. We need to feel into the images of the wasteland. So we return to the mound. We come across Merlin, who is acting in this time as a mound guardian, who takes us into the mysterious place, who takes us to the place in the centre of the forest, the mound, which in the Welsh tradition is called the Mound Arbeth, the Mound of Wonders, that is simultaneously the Castle of the Grail, that is the centre of the mysterious forest Brosilande, which in a way you could say Brosilande is the inner realm, the inside of us, where you can find both the wasteland and the courts of joy. So as we situate ourselves there, as we pay attention to our inner experiences, we start to look at what is happening in our inner world. What's happening in the forest that is mine? What happens in my bit of the forest meets the big forest, the forest that is everybody's forest. Now the nature of the forest, Brosilande, it's fractal. If you look at one part, you find yourself relating to all parts. So if you look at some issue that represents the wasteland in your own life, you will certainly go into that, but then you will find that embedded in other fractals, what's happening in the land, what's happening in the family, what's happening in ancestry, what's happening in the world, what's happening in the universe. In this place where our individual identity is embedded in collective identity. You know that thing as a kid when you write, I don't know if you did this New Year, when you write your address, like Ian Rees, 10 Pantagadugan Road, Craigavon Park, Swansea, South Wales, Great Britain, Europe, the world, the universe, or the solar system, big garden, Milky Way, the universe. Right, so in a way, it's a great thing we do with our kids like that, because actually we are saying something really kind of important about identity, about the embedded nature of identity. So, underneath, whatever we find, there are these other identities, other embedded places. And what we find rising out of the Welsh literature and is this, and arising out certainly out of the poem Prydau Anufen, is this idea of the quest for something, the quest for the cauldron, the quest for the sword of light, the quest to be Pen Anufen, the quest for the grail, the quest for healing, that is a response to the wounding of the world. In the poem, it is the response to the song of the prisoner. So we hear the song of the prisoner, and we respond. The prisoner sings because we respond. It's multivalent causality. In the same way, the grail appears because of the wounding of the wasteland. Is the wounding of the wasteland there to enable the grail to appear? Again, it's that similar causality moving backwards and forwards, in a circular way. Now, the new text I've introduced today is bizarrely entitled Elucidation, the elucidation, the making clear of the grail story. Elucidation, elucidation. Pronounced elucidation from the French, because it's an old French text. After the Welsh start writing these things down, where you find the Grail stories written mostly is first of all in France. The troubadours, Chrétien de Troyes, and in particular, one particular troubadour, Chrétien de Troyes.
I was pronouncing
Christian. Yes, it's Chrétien. Chrétien de Troyes. From Troyes. Chrétien, the troubadour from Troyes, who writes the beginnings of the first Grail story. Not the beginnings of the Arthurian legends. That comes, we find that first written down by Geoffrey of Monmouth, who is the man who writes some of the first, after the Welsh traditions, he's the person who writes first of all about Merlin and Taliesin and Arthur. But for the Grail, the stories of the Grail, we find it in Chrétien de Troyes, the story of Percival, and that becomes a whole big story that you know, and many versions of it, many versions of the Arthur story that follow after.
Percival and Parsifal.
Yeah, they are. The Parsifal is you find in Wolfram von Essenbach's version. So that's a German version. So it's Percival in German. They pronounce it Parsifal, and that's where we get Wagner's opera Parsifal from. It comes out of. So Wolfram von Essenbach, slightly later than Chrétien de Troyes, is also another troubadour type figure. So he writes a set of German verses called Parsifal, which putting his own gloss on it. It's very interesting. Wolfram's Parsifal looks quite influenced by sort of Islamic traditions, and one of the figures actually you always find in the Arthur story somewhere is there is the Saracen knight who represents the opposite. So you've got the opposites of Christianity and Islam in there somewhere. In Wolfram's Parsifal, he has a brother who is the brother of the hero Gamaret. The Gamaret is one of the big figures. has a brother who is black and white in colour, like a sort of dappled horse or something, And he is the he's the Saracen knight in that story. There's a lot of kind of curious stuff in Wolfram, but that's a little later on.
Is he before Geoffrey of Monmouth?
No, Geoffrey of Monmouth is really early. He's one of the first of them, really. So it's from Geoffrey of Monmouth. Geoffrey of Monmouth's Latin writings make the Arthurian story very, very popular. So he's, because he's, what we get Geoffrey of Monmouth does is to, he's writing really for the Norman overlords who identify with being not Saxon, but he's helping them identify with being British and helping to justify their conquest of England. So it becomes very, very popular. So the whole, and there's, because there's lots of good fighting bits in it, which the Norman barons liked, the Arthur stories become incredibly popular. And now based on some very ancient traditions, but the story of Arthur takes off really from Geoffrey of Monmouth. And but the Chwedlian de Troyes thing comes in at another angle, really, because with Chwedlian because some of the stories of Arthur are just about conquest, particularly Arthur conquers Rome and becomes this great. But the Grail stories are really all about wounding and healing. They're about the wasteland and the restoration of the Grail.
Wasn't Chrétien asked to write a kind of French history, and he kind of included those stories?
Yes, that's right.
Made up they were part of French history, yeah, rather than sort of the original reason for writing the stories.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because what do you find? What you find happening there, you see these places, that these guys are always working for patrons, you know, because it goes, you know, they have to please whoever they're kind of working for in that sense. So that's where we come across the underground currents again of history in some ways. So what happens is that Chrétien, in his pleasing his patron, then also includes this story, which is presented as a part of history. Same through Geoffrey of Monmouth. His book is called The History of the Kings of Britain, and it's mostly legendary history that presented as fact, you know. And in later commentaries on Geoffrey, he's called Geoffrey the Famous Liar, because he sort of made all this stuff up. He didn't really make it up. But he's taking mythical history, presenting it as factual history. And so Venerable Bede and people give him a hard time and the liar he was.
Is there a practical aspect to this as well, in that a lot of France was owned by England?
Yeah, totally.
A lot of the early
Huge swathes of it, wasn't it? Yeah, totally. So the idea, when we talk about the matter of Britain, which is what this material comes to, that in the way they were using the matter of Britain, it did include a lot of France, because the England at that time was Norman French, ruled by the Norman French, who also owned quite a lot of France. And Brittany, of course, was Little Britain. You know, it was a part of Britain. So in a way, that the fact that these legends are French and Welsh and Latin, really they're addressing the same kind of area. You know, and of course, geography has shifted over time. But when we come to the Elucidation, we come to a text that is actually genuinely quite an esoteric text. I mean, it's a small 7 pages in translation. It's a smaller in the actual poem form.
More than 7 pages.
Huh?
Book's more than 7 pages.
No, that's not the lesson. Yeah, but there's lots of other things in the book. Right, so the book has all kinds of other stories. But the Elucidation, which is the one we've looked at, is the scene. It's described as the prologue.
Okay, that's the bit you read to us.
The bit I read to you, right? So I've read to you all of the Elucidation, right? And it's a separate little text, which gets inserted sometimes. Like in this book, it's inserted in front of Chrétien de Troyes' story of the Grail. But actually, it's a complete little book on its own. The thing about both the Welsh material and certainly about the Arthurian material, it very quickly gets overwhelming because there's so much of it. I've got an extraordinary book at home called Pierce Forest, which is 1,500 pages. And I have never got, I don't maybe never get to the end of it while I live. But it's very easy if you get into Arthurian things at all to feel, well, the fact's all this about you, it just goes on and on. And it's because really people get very fascinated by the themes and put their own oar into it and write their own pieces of it. So there's, what we're doing here in some ways is looking at some of the key pieces. But as you, if you, and you don't have to get into it at all, I mean, you know, it really, it kind of doesn't matter, except it's useful. For our terms, it's useful. Why it's useful to study this kind of stuff is not really because of the text itself, but because of what happens between us and what it brings up as we study it. Why I like the Elucidación is when it's really short, when it's very concentrated, and it holds a lot of the stuff that makes the Arthurian material both interesting and really frustrating, in that it's full of paradox. You know, it's called the Elucidación, and yet it's about as unclear a text as you could possibly wish. He contradicts himself every other line, pretty much. And it could just be a frustrating thing, but actually what comes out of it, and why it's, I find it useful, is its images and ideas hang around for me. So this image, this appalling image of the destruction of the women of the wells, and this image of the rapist king who steals the cup, and that breakage, if you like, of the link between the well woman and the knight, it really speaks of that sundering of the maleness and femaleness of these of the sword and the cauldron. It really speaks somewhere of the in the graphically horrible image of that somewhere, in a way, it really conveys something of the horror of that. And then the totally drying up of the world, because that's happened. Everything goes into latency. And this idea that's very strong in it, you know, where there are a need for questions, you have to ask questions. And the text only reveals itself slowly. So there are these seven wardens, seven guardians, who are the cloaks of story. It's a nice image. They cloak the story. So they were, and Blahis tells us he's going to tell us all about them. And of course he doesn't. He says, well, one's like the ones about Lancelaginius, one's a, you know, he gives us little hints, but even the hints aren't even that useful. And if we get fixated upon, okay, this is a clue, right? This is a serious clue. One of it's really about the Lancelaginius and what happens there. Maybe it isn't. Maybe that isn't the starting point. The last story is about the shield. So the first is about the lance, the last is about the shield. One of the stories in the middle is about Lancelot of the Lake. At least two of them are about characters we know nothing about. Now, what we have to do, and what did the write-up suggest to us, if we want to find the courts of joy, if we want to restore the land, let the world flow, we need to be like Gawain or like Percival. In a certain sense, we have to let the woman have her way. We have to let the story have its way with us. Not control it. Not grip it firmly through the hints. We have to be like Percival, we have to be like the innocent Percival who keeps asking questions. He's the fool, right? He keeps asking, what's that mean? What's that like? Oh, pretty, what's that like? So that spirit of inquiry, that spirit of curiosity, that vulnerability, in a way that happens when we do that. And it poses quite particular questions in it somewhere. Who does the grail serve? Why does the lance bleed? Why is the sword broken? Sleeps like the dead beneath the hill, maybe. What is the treasure that is in the hall? What is the rich cross of silver? And later on, it's great, really. So I shall never speak of it, because it's a great shame to spoil the story by telling it piecemeal and not in the right order, while he's telling it piecemeal and not in the right order. Right. So he's actually helping us quite a lot through these kind of confusions. You know, what is the great battle? You know, so one of the wardens will tell you the great story of the battle. Somebody else will tell you about the anger and loss of Húdin. What on earth is that? The story of heaven, the knight who is not a coward. Now, if we get very fixated on what are these stories and what do they mean, externally, we will lose something. There are seven branches to the story. There are seven wardens to the story. They will disclose themselves to you only if you behave like Gawain, like Percival. And as part of this, you will have to like Lancelot du Lac. Contemplate your loss of virtue, whatever that means. And that's not a simple thing. Now there's a great... there's a figure called Charles Williams, who is a friend of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, one of the Inklings. Wrote an extraordinary set of Arthurian poems, and we'll look at that sometime later in the year. One of the key poems in it is something called Taliesin at Lancelot's Mass, and it has Lancelot performing a requiem mass for all the dead of the Round Table, even though he's not a priest. And there's something very powerful in this Requiem Mass about this perfect knight who lost his perfection. Because the Mass that he performs, this Requiem, this act of remembrance, embraces the shadowy, painful stuff of each of the members of the Round Table, and hold that intention and offers that up to the highest and deepest part of them. And it culminates in a wonderful kind of phrase, manacled by the web set free. There is no perfect word to describe the joy in me. So this man, and in the poem, he's remembering his life, he's remembering his errors, he's remembering, if you like, the manacles of his relationship, and all the thing, relationships and all the things he's done wrong, the things he's done right. There's that sense of manacled by the web, but by the web set free, by being present, accepting of all his difficulties, all his struggles, all his errors, as well as his successes. By the web set free, there is no capable song or word for the joy that rises in me. You know, that's the point of the story of the Grail is that we embrace our mistakes, our successes, we accept the place where we are the prisoner of the poem in the Prithivanovan, manacled by the web, by accepting that, by embracing the prisoner, by the web, set free. And then we touch that song that is the song that comes out of the courts of joy. That's the place where life flows, where the dead land becomes green again. And then, this is the power of this small story, what happens then is light and shadow reemerge. The order of the table around, the order of the rich retinue. New challenges, new possibilities. Not a static perfection.
Is there someone upstairs?
It seems to be. It's an attic up there, so I don't know what it's there is.
There was an upstairs.
Yeah, there is an upstairs. There's an attic building, so somebody's obviously.
No.
Now, the point of a story like L'Elicitation is that it focuses our attention, it becomes a mirror. Stories are mirrors, ultimately. They bring the right story brings you back to yourself and the dilemmas of your own life and the world that you find yourself in. And inevitably, in the course of this course, we'll go over quite a lot of different stories and sort of, but the very key thing is to find your own connection to this deeper part of yourself, which may be through story or may not be through story. You know, story isn't the only way. That's why we're looking at various ways of connecting. It's not, you know, the story is one way. Tree of Life is another way. Meditation is one way. You know, we're looking at various kind of methods. And the key, very key thing is to discover and trust the way that works for you. The other key thing, though, is the act of embodiment. It is to let these things be felt in our bodies, and because in a way the fundamental place in all of this, the deep well is the well of the body. It's the what we do, all of the things we do involve us getting present in the body, present in our senses, and relaxing into what is underneath the surface. And then as we do that, looking at what helps us, what carries us. You know, there's some of the images of sleighs, of horses, of kind of, you know, these are important images in some ways, because it's, as we touch into these places, we need assistance. So we need the help of whatever arises up from the deeper place, in whatever form it does, in order to help us continue on our way towards the courts of joy. I was looking earlier today about the Stevie's book, The Triads of Britain, and I did my thing of just opening a page and just seeing what's there. And this time, today, I got the three bestowed horses of the island of Britain. Slender Grey, the horse of Caswallan, son of Belly. pale yellow of the stud, horse of Cly, skilful hand, and host splitter, horse of Caradog, strong arm. Now, in the stories that these horses come from, these horses are they carry the heroes where they need to go. They are almost like spirit companions, guardians, helpers, whose nature corresponds to the nature of the hero. And so one of the serious questions in all of this, in all this work, in all of what we're doing, is what is there to help? What spirit, what companions come to help me on the way? What is the horse that carries me? What helps me to connect to these deeper places? The tarot pack could be a horse, the tree of life could be a horse, the Welsh poem could be a horse, anything could be a horse. As long as it helps you deepen, as long as it reminds you that you are more than the small dialogue that tells you nothing can change. The horses take us somewhere else. They take us through the host of our enemies. Host splitter, who carries Caradog's strong arm through the battle. Pale yellow of the stud, how horse of Cly's skillful hand, is part of the story of the fourth branch of the Mabinogion. He carries Cly, who is the sort of the, in a way, the Christ figure of the Mabinogion at the end. Slender grey, horse of Caswellan, son of Beli. Slender grey, Caswellan, son of Beli, a slightly controversial figure who gives the Romans permission to come to Britain and is given Slender Grey as a gift. So one of the questions might be, well, what is the horse that carries you? What is the horse that you, if we take this image of the quest, you know, what knights need, knights errants need, they need armor, they need the sword, they need the shield, but they also need a horse to carry them. So if we consider that we need the sword, we need the shield, we need the horse that will take us to the cauldron or take us to the cup. Maybe we also need the lance. Now, what are these things? What do these things mean for us, in a way? So the difficult thing, I think, I mean, one of the problems of having to teach like this is we have to cram it in 2 days, and another month we'll do it again, just because of the way life is. And in some ways it means we have to get into too much, really, and then rely on the space in between to help you unpack and digest and find what is good for you in it. Because in the end, what's good isn't a lot. I have to give you indigestion a bit in the 2 days. Because in order to, for us to sort of, in a way, do the work that we need to do in these 2 days, I have to give you too much, and we have to stick at this too long. 2 days is a very long time to be hammering away at these deep inner things. Because in the end, really, what we're looking to find here is the stories or methods or ways of being that enable you to sustain your connection with these deeper parts of yourself. Not to create connection, because that's there all the time, but it's a connection that's continually obscured by the inner dialogue. The dialogues. And so in finding the horse that carries you, it's to find the particular vehicle, the particular ways that carry you on your version of the quest. You know, in the Arthurian stories, all the knights go off, you know, they come from common place, right? So they sit around a round table, just like we do here. And then they go off. They go off into the forest. Occasionally they meet each other and they do something together. But most of the time they're having very, very individual kind of journeys. And in a way, that's literally what we do. You know, we're going to end in an hour or something, half an hour. And then we go off and we have our individual journeys, and some of us might see each other and some of us might not. And the quest kind of continues. There's something about being literal about this that's important. Nothing we do here is symbolic. It's always stupid, there is symbolism involved. But actually, the point of the stories is to be kind of literal about them. To take literally the idea that you're on a quest, literally that you're coming into relationship with the cauldron of inspiration or the sword of light. So that we literally gather here together, most of us, with three of a number absent this time, pursuing their own quests. Susie's creating a new castle. I'm not sure what Nicholas is doing. Reagan is helping to heal a bereaved friend. You know, so their quests mean that as would have literally happened at the round table, where so and so, oh, they're off on a quest. So three of a number are not here because they're actively in their own quests this weekend. So being sort of childlike again in this way, right, is one of the best and most important way. Not being sophisticated about these stories is the best way to approach them. You know, if you read some of the Jungian literature on the Grey Legends, Emma Jung's book on the Grey Legends, I've never in all my life, much as I love Jung, much as I love the Grey Legends, I have never been able to get through that book because it is so symbolic, so cognitive, so complicated. And I'm sure that it was very meaningful for her and can be meaningful to some people. It doesn't speak to me, because the point of these early stories is they're intended, you know, and the Iliad Hesiod makes it quite clear, you have to be like Percival, you have to be like the innocent fool. So you have to be quite childlike in addressing the stories and in your engagement with them. And the just going to end really today with this, some thoughts about Alan Garner, who is my hero, who really has done this. He's this man who's, you know, he's probably the writer that most represents the Mabinogion, I think, in his writing. But he does it not by writing books about the Mabinogion. He does it by distilling down those experiences inside himself and then writing normally quite short, incredibly concentrated works, novels, sometimes collections of stories, essays, one book of essays, that really take us into the heart of the material. And for him, he centers it all on a fusion of the Mabinogion stories and the story of Alderley Edge, of a king sleeping, a king and his knights sleeping underneath, and their horses sleeping underneath a hill, guarded by a wizard. It's a very short story. Yet as he expands from that base and as he writes his stories, he brings in at various times all the Mabinogion. So in one of his very early books, we find the figure of Angharad Goldenhand, who is one of the great suppose we could say, one of the great well women, if I do use that image. But she's also one of the great protectors of the mythic land of Britain, Logres. Now, in the very first book, The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, which is based on the legend of the Sleeping King, who is sleeping. It's an Arthurian analogue, because the king is waiting for when he is needed again. When he is in his nights and needed to ride out in the world to combat a great evil. And the Weird Stone of Brisingamen is a stone that keeps the magic intact, that keeps the knights safe and sleeping, so that they will emerge when they're needed and not before. This is very like the Lysidesion. The story will emerge when it is needed and not before. But one of the key places in the book, that there are two children involved in it, that one of which actually has the Weird Stone of Brisingamen on her wrist, and she doesn't know it. And nor does the magician figure, doesn't see it. And it is stolen from the child by the forces of darkness. And the children go on this amazing journey, which involves journeying down into the earth, into the darkest places of the earth. It involves them going into a house where a terrible magic is being performed, and then them being pursued by all kinds of unpleasant beings, many of whom are dressed as hikers, because they're very ordinary unpleasant beings.
Hasn't the author just written a second book?
He's written a third book, a third book called Boneland, which is, he's written a whole number of books, but the first book was this Weird Song of Brisingamen, for these characters, Colin and Susan. Then there's a follow-up called The Moon of Gomorrah. Now, he'd wrote nothing about them for 30-odd years. And now he's written, last year wrote Boneland, which is the third of the trilogy, which is a work of genius because it takes Colin as he would be now at his age. And it's an adult book, it's not a book for children. The first two books are books for children and are very, in some ways very powerfully mythically, but quite straightforward. In the third book, he takes the themes. Colin, Susan has vanished. Or been murdered, maybe by Colin, we don't know. And it's a very ambiguous book, it's a very adult book, very, very powerful, but really takes those themes into a really new place. And one of the interesting themes that's there in all three books really is about the necessity for the woman of the well to return. Because what we find is that we have these knights and king looked after by a male magician, and something has gone wrong, and the stone is in the possession of a small girl child, and the magician cannot see the stone, and it is the children, the innocent children, the Percivals, if you like, who retrieve the stone and then are pursued. And then there's a really important part of the story where Angharad Goldenhand, they're in real terrible trouble, and then they find themselves, they stumble by accident into a small, turns out to be floating island, and they come into the hands of Angharad Goldenhand, who is the wife of the king, and who not only protects them, gives to Susan a bracelet that represents the power of the new moon, and brings something new back in. So something new comes back into the world with Colin, with Susan, as the gift of Angharad Goldenhand. And in a way, what he's done from this small kid story really, is really address the key themes of the Grail, of loss and restitution. And he continues working on this, and very powerfully does it in Boneland, in a kind of extraordinary way. But what he does, through a very, very short description of Angharad Goldenhand, is bring her into focus. She's one of the figures found in a story called Cilhwch and Olwen. She's just mentioned as one of the most beautiful women of the Isle of Britain. So, what I'd like to do, just for a moment, if you will, is just close your eyes. Just relax. And just for a moment, imagine you're just sinking down and in, following the gravity well of the body just again. And you will immediately find yourself in the hall of Angharad Goldenhand, in the floating island that floats on the borders of the mind, on the borders of the world. But she is one of the greatest of all the well women, and she in this moment will give to you what it is you most need, will feed you and will speak to you out of the deep well. So receive from Angharad Goldenhand. Whatever it is you most need. still just about daylight. Amazing. Year is turning.